All right, we're going to be talking this morning about the wrath of God. I'm taking a break today from the book of Mark. I don't know why. Just because this subject has been on my mind and my heart lately, and I just, I felt like I needed to talk about it. So we're going to talk about this morning the wrath of God. Let me ask you a question to start out this morning. What is God like? I mean, if someone came up to you that didn't have a clue and just said, what is God like? Tell me what He's like. If you ask the average Christian that, what are they going to tell you? God is what? He's love. That's the first thing they're going to say. God is love. That might be the only thing they have to say. Is that true? Is God love? Is it true? Okay. Yes, it's absolutely true. 1 John 4:8 says, the one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. John also says that in 1 John 4:16. We have come to know and have believed the love which God has for us. God is love, and the one who abides in love abides in God, and God abides in him. To say that God is love is the truth. But is it the whole truth? But see, that's the problem with our society. Most people just, we want to stop there. That's all we want to know about God. That's the only thing, the only piece of information we really want. He's love. That makes us feel pretty good. I like the idea that God is love. I thank the Lord for that. If it wasn't, where would any of us be? But love is not the only attribute that God has. God is holy, the Bible tells us, which is one of, I guess, his main attribute. Kind of everything ties into his holiness. God is merciful. He is gracious. He is just. He is omniscient. He is immutable. He is sovereign. We could go on and on and on listing the different attributes that make up God so we could try to describe God to somebody. God's attributes are his characteristics. There are the excellencies or qualities exercised in his work in creation, in providence, and in redemption. We call them attributes not because we add them to the essence of God, but rather because they inhere in Him. They were and ever will be His. They tell us something about God's substance, His invisible essence. And God has communicable attributes and He has incommunicable attributes. I think you understand that just by we talk about an incommunicable disease and a communicable disease. You know, there's things that God has that nobody shares. There's other things, attributes that He shares with us. But here's what we have to understand. Apart from an objective standard, we can make God into anything we want. What is our objective standard that we use? It's the Bible, right? The Bible is the self-revelation of God. If you're going to know God, you're going to learn about Him from the Scriptures. You say, well, I thought the Romans says the heavens declare the glory of God, the firmament. Yes, listen, we know that God can be seen in the sense we can be aware and be realize there is a God from creation. We know that something had to create it. From nothing comes nothing. But if you want to learn about God, you've got to go to the Scriptures. That's where He has revealed Himself. And I think that's probably really the problem of our day. You are Bible ignorant. Even among Christians, we don't spend time in the Scriptures. We just listen to what other people tell us about the Scriptures. We don't read. We don't learn from God Himself. And I think that most people believe in a God of their own invention. In other words, we hear about it. We think, well, God would be nice if He was like this. And so that's the God we worship. That's the God we serve, the one we have created. It makes us feel good. We make a God that we're comfortable with. A God who is only love. He loves everybody. He puts up with everything. He's just a nice, gentle old man. Listen, folks, that is not the God of the Bible. And it amazes me that anybody who has read the Bible comes up with this concept that God is only love and that's all there is to it. A.W. Tozer wrote this, "Perverted notions about God soon rot the religion in which they appear. The long career of Israel demonstrates this clearly enough, and the history of the church confirms it. So necessary to the church is a lofty concept of God that when that concept in any measure declines, the church with her worship and her moral standards declines along with it. The first step down for any church is taken when it surrenders its high opinion of God. And folks, listen, let me tell you how we bring God down. We do that by lifting man up. And that's our society today. We have elevated man, thus we have brought God down. We think man is much more superior, much more worthy, much more noble than he actually is, and therefore we bring God down. Listen, it is not right for us to pick out an attribute of God we like and reduce him to that attribute. When we do that, we basically just have created a God. This is idolatry. Believing the wrong thing about God is idolatry. Remember when the children of Israel, when Moses up on the mountain and they made the calf, they were worshiping. What were they worshiping? They were saying, hey, this is the God that brought us out of Egypt. That wasn't the God that brought them out of Egypt. When we think about idolatry, often we'll think about, you know, some guy in a mud hut with a little totem pole out in front of his hut worshiping that. Or we think of some of the elaborate temples that are built at people burning incense. But idolatry is much broader than that. Idolatry is simply thinking something about God that is untrue of Him. It's postulating anything about God that is not right. It's creating a God. Now, in its secondary stage, it's making the God who is into something that He isn't. And maybe in a third level, which even Christians, I think, are guilty of, it's thinking thoughts of God that are untrue of Him. Listen, if God has revealed Himself, and I believe He has in the Scriptures, and it's our responsibility to know that. And there's many people who are going to say, well, I didn't know God was like this. Well, maybe if you shut off the TV, maybe if you turned off the video games and spent a little time in the Bible, you'd understand who He is. He's revealed Himself. But we have to spend time with Him so we understand who He is. I love what Psalms 50, 21 and 22 says. God says, these things you have done, and I kept silent. You thought that I was just like you. I will reprove you and state the case in order before your eyes. Now consider this, you who forget God, lest I tear you in pieces. How'd that get in there? And there be none to deliver you. God says, you thought I was like you. Do you think that? Do you think God's like you? I think we all have a tendency to do that. At least we want Him to be. That way, you know, He's thinking on the right line. You think of God as a cosmic errand boy, a gentle old grandpa who wouldn't hurt anybody, who puts up with everybody's sin, who just allows people to do whatever they want to and say, well, that's okay, we'll overlook that. Is your God too small? I think the thing we have to understand as we look in the Bible, and one thing we see very clearly, is God is not like us. First of all, God is holy. Isaiah 6:3 says, and one called to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory. To be holy is to be distinct. It's to be separate. It's to be in a class by Himself. R.C. Sproul said this, I think a good definition. He said, the primary meaning of holy is separate. It comes from an ancient word that meant to cut or to separate. Perhaps even more accurate would be the phrase, a cut above something. When you find a garment or another piece of merchandise that is outstanding, that has a superior excellence, we use the expression, it's a cut above the rest. That's the idea of holy. It means separate, transcendent. He is far different than we are. He is uniquely holy, with no rivals, with no competition. And when the Bible calls God holy, it means primarily that He is transcendently separate. He is so far above and beyond that He seems almost totally foreign to us. To be holy is to be other, to be different in a special way. The God of the Bible, as we read the Bible, He does as He pleases. He accomplishes what He sets out to do. No plan of His is thwarted by the whims and decisions of mankind. He is wrathful against our rebellion, yet loving beyond our imagination. And one of the most concise and profound statements ever written on the subject, A.W. Pink said this. This is one of my favorite quotes of Pink. I think he really hit the nail on the head. and he wrote this a long time ago. He said, "The God of this 20th century no more resembles the supreme sovereign of Holy Writ than does the dim flickering of a candle the glory of the midday sun." Now you think about that. I think he's right on. The God of the 20th century doesn't resemble the God of the Bible. The quote goes on to say, "The God who is now talked about in the average pulpit, spoken of in the ordinary Sunday school, mentioned in much of the religious literature of the day, and preached in most of the so-called Bible conferences, is a figment of human imagination, an invention of maudlin sentimentality. The heathen outside the pale of Christendom form gods out of wood and stone, while the millions of heathen inside Christendom manufacture a god out of their own carnal mind. In reality, they are but atheists, for there is no other possible alternative between an absolutely supreme God and no God at all. A God whose will is resisted, whose designs are frustrated, whose purpose is checkmated, possesses no title to deity, and so far from being a fit object of worship, merits naught but contempt." Strong words from A.W. Pink, but I think he's right on there. We have to understand that we cannot take the Bible or the God of the Bible and reduce him to something we are comfortable with. We have to accept him for what we find in the Bible. You know, he's God. I get into these discussions during the week with people and they get upset about, "Well, God, did God do that?" And they get upset and I'm like, "Wait a second, let's back up a step. Rule number one, he's the creator." Okay? As creator, guess what you can do? Whatever you want. Whatever you want. You know, there's nobody who holds God accountable. He doesn't answer to anybody. He doesn't check in and say, "Oh, why did you do this, God?" He doesn't. He's the creator. He does what he wants. And what he wants and what he does are always right. Because he is the creator. Well, God's holiness is linked to his righteousness and his justice. There are aspects of his holiness that manifest in his treatment of his creatures. Psalm 97:2 says, "Clouds and thick darkness surround him. Righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne." Because God is holy, because he is just, listen, he must punish sin. Even the slightest sin defies the authority of God. It insults his majesty. It challenges his justice. And because of our sin, listen, people, we all deserve the wrath of God. That's where you need to start as a human being, okay? Romans 1:18, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." We all deserve wrath. That's where we have to start. That's the starting point, okay? Every human being ever born deserves to fall under the wrath of God because every human being ever born has sinned. You know what's interesting in this verse? God does not hide his wrath. It says the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. It's disclosed. It's brought to light. It's made known. He expresses it. Not in violent, uncontrolled explosions, but nevertheless by definite, observable acts. And whenever it is expressed, it is always against ungodliness and unrighteousness. Ungodliness involves our attitude towards God, our irreverence or disregard of His will for us. Unrighteousness has to do with our treatment of fellow man. So His wrath comes against any ungodliness and unrighteousness. God's wrath is always expressed against sin. And we got to understand, believer, that's the only thing we deserve is wrath. The only thing that God owes us is wrath. If we could get everybody to start from that point, it would stop a lot of complaining, a lot of griping, a lot of murmuring against God, and realize anything short of wrath is something to really be thankful for. And I think if we really understood the depth of our sin, and if we really understood the holiness of God, we would thank God every day that He hasn't killed us, that He hasn't consigned us to the lake of fire. And you know, churchianity today is so lopsided in this issue of love that we have decided that God must love everybody. And if He doesn't love everybody, then He can't be our God. And I think most people within churchianity believe that they are worthy of God's love. They are worthy of His goodness. They actually think that God owes them. And in this twisted view, God is the debtor and man the creditor. If God loves all men, it's strange that God sends some to hell as soon as they die. I mean, God loves some men to death, we're saying. God loves some men to everlasting torment. There's something wrong here. Either God loves man and will not send him to the furnace of eternal wrath, or He sends him into His eternal wrath because He doesn't love him. I had a discussion about a month ago with this guy, and he said, oh, God loves everybody. And that was the first question I asked him. Does He love the people in hell? And he stopped, and he was like, I got to go. He packed up his stuff and he left. He does that every time we get into a discussion. He leaves because... Because he said, God loves everybody. I said, have you read the Old Testament? And he has not read the whole thing. But I said, well, you don't have to read it all, but you read most of it. You see, did God love the Canaanites? Did He love the Amorites? The Hittites? The Jebusites? Did God love these people? Do you know what God did to those people using Israel? Strong stuff in there. Most people don't want to think of God's wrath at all. They prefer to think and speak only of His love. That makes us feel better. And those who do believe God is a God of wrath, as well as a God of love, prefer to think of His wrath in the past tense. And I've heard a lot of people say to me, well, that was the God of the Old Testament. And I'm saying, did we get a new God in the New Testament? The Old Testament God left and we got a brand new one? Hi, that guy didn't do a very good job. Let me take over. God number two. No, where does that come from? People think that God's wrath is an Old Testament concept. And like when Christ came, then it was safe to think in fact of love, and we don't have anything to worry about anymore. You know, people say, well, He's not doing that today. And I've had this debate many times. I'm thinking, you know, the more I think about that, listen, does God express His wrath today? Did He just quit all of a sudden and say, okay, from now on, no more wrath? I mean, if you look at the Old Testament and you look at the Bible and you see how He displayed His wrath, does it happen today? He displayed it through all different sorts. He displayed it through weather. He displayed it through armies. He displayed it, you know, using people to judge other people. And we think today that it's not over. The only thing different today is we don't have a written commentary explaining when something happens, that was the wrath of God. A.W. Pink says this, it's sad to find so many professing Christians who appear to regard the wrath of God as something for which they need to make an apology, or at least they wish there were no such thing. While some would not go so far as to openly admit that they consider it a blemish on the divine character, yet they are far from regarding it with delight.